Hi, lovely listeners. You might have noticed that we've changed our name for reasons both annoying and legal. Like my kids said when I tried to get them into Sufjan Stevens, it wasn't our favorite, but we moved on and are excited to be coming to you now in a new packaging with the same great taste as the mother of it all. We also rode these winds of change and did something we really wanted to do, which is launch the podcast on Substack. You'll still find us wherever you listen, but you can also go to motherofitall.substack.com to subscribe and get every episode in your inbox, comment on episodes, read episode transcripts, see bonus posts from us throughout the season and during our summer break, and experience the many fun extras we have planned for season two. Thanks for supporting us as we continue to explore and expand what this project can and should be. We treasure you.
I'm Miranda Rake.
And I'm Sarah Wheeler, and this is The Mother of It All, where we take on culture through the lens of motherhood and motherhood through the lens of culture.
Sarah, we have a new name.
That felt so vulnerable. I feel like I'm standing naked vocally in front of the masses.
It feels good.
It feels good. How do you feel? You feel good? I'm excited. Mm-hmm. And I did want to just say to the public that the new podcast name, it's like the baby is already born. You know, you're not allowed to give feedback now anymore. The baby has already been named Governor. Mm-hmm. And you love Governor and you're going to write Governor's name in all of your, of your birthday cards with glee. It's not pre-baby coming discussion.
The baby's name is The Mother of It All.
Yay!
And we're going with it. And we do appreciate all the people who voted for Beef and Broccoli,
though. Yeah, Beef and Broccoli was a strong second runner.
We're still not sure who is the beef and who is the broccoli. But I think, we talked previously about how whenever someone says Pinterest, I hear Pin Interest. And I wonder if there'll always be a part of me that hears The Mother of It All and makes a little beef and broccoli joke
in
my head.
Yeah, starring beef and broccoli. Starring Sarah Wheeler as the beef. I think we decided on the beef.
Yeah, I think you're
right. But I don't know if I should be like, it's a good thing, you know?
Well, I think it is. I think that in beef and broccoli.
Tough.
It's not beef and broccoli without the beef and the broccoli,
Yeah, you need both. It's true. You don't just want a big slab of meat or a pile of broccoli. Good point.
Yeah.
For anyone who wasn't following on social media, we had to change our name. We didn't want to, but we see the good in it. Mm-hmm. It's a new beginning. And we did go and have a tarot reading, which we described in more detail in the last episode. And she was convinced that it's only going to bring good things for us.
It was a learning
experience. She was very
convincing.
Yeah,
I think we learned some.
You mean
really
the tarot reading or the
things.
Name change?
Both.
Oh yeah, the tarot reading was a learning experience. Yeah. She told me I don't need any more ideas. She was like, "You don't need any more ideas." It's like, all right, mom.
She was a little scary in a good way. I think that I respond pretty well too, where I'm like, it's good for me to just feel intimidated and sit and listen.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. Is that why you do this podcast with me?
Is it? Maybe. I
do. I'm just kidding. I think you intimidate me.
What?
You, no. You actually read. It's
you
very...
read so much more than I do. We need to do some kind of summer reading program together and see if we both.
Can we get stars and a pizza party if we get enough points?
Oh my gosh. We should do the Mother of It All summer reading.
Oh
because
my
we're gonna
gosh.
Take the summer off and we could do a little printable thing and if you get all the stars you get a t-shirt.
Remember at the library? I can remember the smell of my childhood library in the summer. It was like in a basement. And when you'd go in to like get your stickers or like what stamps or whatever to be like and I would always do like I'm just looking for a cheat, So I would be like, I read 100 like 4-page books that had 4 words on them, and they would like, begrudgingly give me all my stamps and I would just like breathe in and be like, I'm a fucking champion.
I think it was stamps. It was stamps, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was totally stamps.
We didn't waste as much back then.
So I remembered being very motivated to get the shirt at the end.
There was a shirt?
So for us, the library I went to, there was a shirt, but my husband has this whole thing about a pizza thing. Like you got a, okay, was that for
you too? I think so. Maybe I like superimposed it on just from like the cultural, like, you know, I don't know, sharing of it all, that it is like, there's a lot of pizza parties. A lot of people remember the summer reading library pizza party, but we might've gotten something shittier than a pizza party or a shirt, like a free book, you know, where you're like, no, I didn't read for more reading.
Right. Right. Like, no, I don't want that.
No, I don't like reading. I like winning.
This is the place. Yeah, you guys have the books. I want the stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I know where to get the books. give me one of those little frogs, that plastic frogs that you like, you know, put your finger, flip the bottom, and then it like flips upside down and then it breaks immediately. That's what I want.
You know, thank God. This is so bad, but like plastic crap. Like it sometimes really comes through for you. Like sometimes my, you know, when I need to motivate my older kid for something, it's like nothing tops just plastic garbage. And
yeah,
like he got this ninja set yesterday. It was like $19.99.
You were excited. You mean?
No, he's excited.
Oh, like, okay. I thought you were saying go back to your love of plastic and her like, don't forget to get out the weapons. And
needed to get motivated to get a haircut. And so we said he could get a toy at the local grocery store.
We
and
do like, a Pokemon pack, by the way.
Yeah, he just lives for that stuff, right? Yeah. And he was like, oh my God, I can pick anything I want. And I usually give a budget. You know, it's like, okay, here's our budget. And like $20 was a really big budget. And he was like, and we don't do gun toys. So he was moping around.
Only real guns. No gun toys. Because it's real. It's like Waldorf. It has to be an authentic tool in your household.
God. I'm going to have to pause and cry for a while.
I'm sorry.
Okay. But like, so he was like standing there and he was like, I will love you forever if you just get me this gun toy. You know, and I was like, I don't want to engage too much because he like knows how I feel. And I will start crying in the aisles of the grocery store about if I have to talk about why we can't have gun toys. Aww. And so I was like, I'm sure we can find something cool, you know? And so then we found this ninja set and I was like,
yeah,
I really doubled down. I was like, anyone can shoot a gun, but like you need skills to be a ninja.
Yeah.
Like,
you ninjas cannot, don't, you know, go into public places and I mean, you know, in movies.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, it was, but like the plastic crap, I mean, he was like hugging it. He like slept with it. He's like, he's living for this. I don't know why.
He's inhaling all of the cancerous microfibers.
Oh yeah. You probably can't get it in California because they banned all the good
things. They don't actually ban any of that stuff. They just put a sticker on it that's like, you will die when you open this, but we don't care. And then
we told you.
Yeah. And because like we're just the worst, you're like,
We're like, I'll worry about that later.
The plastic is amazing. The PTA president at my school, who is a friend who I love so much, his like first year as PTA president for the spring fling. He was like, I was like, what's your plan, Ed? And he's like, well, we're going to have like, you know, we're going to have like the bike that makes the smoothies and we're going to have like, you know, beanbag games. And then like, we're not going to do like the shitty plastic prizes because like, you know, the earth is dying and we need to like teach our kids. And I was like, you know, I've been in education for like 20 years. I've been to a lot of spring flings. I was kind of like, all right, you know, good luck with that. And then I like showed up at the spring fling and there was just a cornucopia of garbage, you know, like the little plastic stamps and then like, the parachuting guys and the sticky hands, just things that like will end up in the trash or the ocean or boat, you know, in the next 48 hours.
They are the reason
the kids were so happy.
Have to move to space. Like,
yeah.
You know,
it's the sticky hands. It's just it's when you add up all those sticky hands. Yeah, we're going to be launched into space by a giant sticky hand that says, thanks for leaving us the planet.
Anyway, well, on that note, I think, shall we welcome our guest?
Let's do it. This is our first mother of it all guest. It's
oh my gosh, right?
It's the Lucy of it all.
Yes, the Lucy of it all. Okay. Well, today we are so excited because we've been itching to get our hands on Lucy Jones' book, Matrescence, since we started working on this podcast.
Yeah, it really was like one of the first books we talked about.
Yeah.
Where we were like, let's start a podcast so we can talk about this book and pretend it's a job.
Yes, exactly. We were like, there's a reason to make this podcast because if Lucy Jones wrote Matrescence, obviously this is a real topic. So yeah,
at least one person cares. That's all we need.
So her book is in our hands and it is available for pre-order right now. It comes out May 7th. So very soon, I think after this goes live.
Next day.
And it's a rich and wonderful multidisciplinary exploration of Lucy's own matrescence, as well as an artfully woven argument for the concept of matrescence itself. If you're not familiar with the term, just keep listening. We're going to get into it. Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you so much. I am such a fan of the pod and you guys and your writing, and I love the new name.
You have to say that.
I really do.
But
though,
we accept.
Genuinely, and it's a real honor to be here. Thank you.
We're so happy to have you.
We're so happy to have you. And so, Lucy, we always begin, before we get into the book, we always start by asking our guests, who is caring for your kids?
Mm.
So what are they?
I think no one, right? Because we can hear them just.
I love that. My husband is. My husband is. So he clocks off around now, and he is looking after them right now.
And you have three?
You have three?
Yeah. Yes,
I
do.
How old are they?
7, 4, very nearly 5, and just 3.
Okay. I was thinking, you know, when I read the book, I know you had a baby in 2021, right? Because I did as well. And yeah. She'll be 3 in July.
Okay. Similar ages.
Yes.
And so she was born in the pandemic.
I was going to say, I feel a kinship for you because that was, what a time to have a baby.
Yeah. Really intense.
It was very intense. Yeah. And I only had one older kid at home, not two. But
it was a blur for sure.
Yes. Yes. But we made it. Here we are. Okay. I want to start out with, I'm looking at my show notes and just as you write about in the book, the word matrescence has the annoying little squiggly line under it because Google Docs is like, this is not a word. And this word is so important. So even though the concept of matrescence, as I understand it, has been around since the 70s, particularly in like academic circles, I had a similar experience to the one that you write about in the book of I think it was after my second child was born, stumbling around trying to be like, what happened to me, that I came across this concept. And I just, I was like, what the heck? So if it's okay, I'm going to read this short passage from the book where you write about discovering this word. So you write, when our baby was 9 months old, I had a breakthrough. I happened upon a word I had never read before in an article in the New York Times written by a reproductive psychiatrist called Alexandra Sachs. It was a word that brought together everything I was feeling, seeing, and reading about. Matrescence. The process of becoming a mother, which anthropologists call matrescence, has been largely unexplored in the medical community, Sachs writes. Instead of focusing on the women's identity transition, more research is focused on how the baby turns out. But a woman's story, in addition to how her psychology impacts her parenting, is important to examine too. I breathed. The article mentions the mixture of emotions that mothers experience. Joy, yes, at least some of the time. But most mothers also experience worry, disappointment, guilt, competition, frustration, and even anger and fear. The idea that this was normal made my shoulders drop in relief for the first time in months.
Yeah, we're both just a little wipe.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt too. And I also felt I was sort of enraged that I had never heard this word before. And the way I think it's Aralee Athon, who also writes a lot about this, I think she kind of says all the time, matrescence like adolescence. And, you know, anyway, I want to hear about your experience of encountering this word and what felt so paradigm shifting about it to you at the time and now.
Thank you so much, Miranda, for reading that. And yes, enraging, that I relate a lot. So I guess to give a little bit of context, I had my first child in 2016, and I came into motherhood with very little experience of being around young children. Like, I never changed a nappy. Like, I think a couple of my friends had kids, but, you know, I was living in like East London and Hackney, and like wasn't seeing kind of young children. And of course, wasn't really talking to like mothers about their actual experience of motherhood, because I think I didn't have the language. But I also came into motherhood with like really kind of classic dominant ideas about self-reliance and self-sufficiency, and a kind of allergic, like an allergy to asking for help or like accepting help, like this idea that, you know, I should be able to do everything alone and be really strong. And and I also thought that I had understood that pregnancy was like a one-time transient hormonal event. And I thought once like the baby was born, it would obviously be a huge change because I'd be a parent and have this like vast responsibility. And of course I anticipated that would be a challenge and probably quite tiring. But I really thought that at that point of birth, then I would just go back to who I was before. Like my midwife would say like 9 months on, 9 months off about baby weight, 7 years on, still there. You know, like everything was about bounce back culture. And, you know, I mean, I feel kind of guilty complaining about us having 9 months of maternity leave to you guys. But, you know, we have 9 months of really badly paid maternity leave.
Yeah, I would like kind of throw up in my mouth a little bit every time I read that in your book. I mean, like, I was happy, but I was also like, oh, and then just to be like, oh, but that doesn't fix anything. Like, that doesn't fix everything. We have this belief that, like, you know, one thing will be the silver bullet. You know, I think that's maybe a very American thing. But, and so, you know, you can get fixated on like, oh, if I had 9 to 12 months, what would I, you know, but so it's UK, both like wild to hear, but it's comforting to be like, oh, it's more complicated than that.
Does it cover, so just to cover quickly, so the government pays you for 9 months, is your job has to be held for you or no?
Like, yeah, but no. I mean, the amount of women who lose their jobs, you know, it's like an epidemic. Like, so many women lose their jobs when they're pregnant or in maternity leave.
And so do a lot of people just go back because they don't want to, like, do they opt out of that 9 months to not lose their job?
I think some people would go back. I think as a freelance, I got the equivalent of like £550 a month. So I guess that's like $1,000 a month or something, maybe a bit less.
Yeah.
So like not very much.
Yeah. It's kind of like unemployment.
Yeah. So like you can, you know, so I continued to work a bit anyway, because you're allowed to work a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I relate to what you're saying, Sarah, because I feel the same about, there are certain countries in Europe, like obviously the Scandi ones.
And, oh yeah, you're so like, get the baby boxes and stuff.
Yeah. And, like, and they get like 3 years or something, which like, they can split. And like, I think Romania and Germany also have like really generous, like England is actually, even though like our government would like crow about our maternity leave, if you look at like the kind of OECD graphs, like it's actually really low paid compared with a lot of other countries.
Yeah, the but countries like, where like a tough but loving nan, like, you know, grandma comes every morning and like makes you a smorgasbord. And yeah. So you're so close to those, it must be hard. You can kind of peer over and see it.
So I had this idea, that I would like have this 9 month period off.
Yeah.
And then you know, go back to work as normal, like go back to myself and my working life, etc.
Yeah, the phrase bounce back is that you used is so powerful. I really responded to that just hearing it from you today, like, oh
yeah, yeah. Like that just says everything, doesn't it, in so many ways. It's like bounce back physically, psychologically, like, you know, there's no room, as we know. Anyway, and I I had a kind of tricky first years, and the only book that I found myself like constantly drawn to and soothed by was Kafka's Metamorphosis. You know, where Gregor Samsa, the salesman, turns into an insect overnight. He turns into like a massive cockroach or something, and he's like, the first page of that literally describes like the isolated intensive institution of motherhood. He's like in his room, he's like, what the, and his family are kind of like very, he feels really alienated from everyone. Anyway, so I was diagnosed with postnatal depression. I had like really high anxiety. I think I probably had birth trauma looking back, and I was really lonely, isolated, like a lot of the stuff, very felt, I've had really bad difficulties with feeding and stuff. But I felt really like super ashamed, like in that first 9 months, like this was like totally my fault. It was like my wrongness, my badness. Everyone was doing it okay. Like I was like imagining that it was, something was going on to me, with me. And you know, that shame and stigma made me isolate myself even more. And I stopped like going out and talking to people, and just felt really totally bewildered by it all. And then read the piece by Sachs in the New York Times, saw this woman Tressence, and I was just like, oh, you know, like this is it. This is not like me being crazy and oversensitive. And
right, I am a giant cockroach.
I am a giant
that
cockroach.
Is what's happened. I'm not hallucinating.
And to get rid, you know, the idea that that difference that you're talking about, where this narrative of bounce back, anything about going back, I think when I discovered the word matrescence, and I assume you felt this way too, and this is kind of where the rage comes in, it was like, why? So you're telling me that people have known for decades that we're going through this complex developmental stage and like changing forever, and that's normal. But like, that's not what culture and society is telling us. And it was like, why?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love when you list, Lucy, like the rituals for adolescence in different cultures, like quinceañeras, yes, and, you know, mitzvahs, b'nai mitzvahs, and that, like, yeah, for becoming a mother, you know, like maybe there's the baby shower, but it's really about the baby. I underlined this beautiful passage where you were talking about a community that uses the, like in their language, the term for giving birth is, the way that they announce it is not, you know, a baby's been born, but a woman has given birth. And like just that simple shift in kind of where you locate the event is really paradigm shifting.
Absolutely. And that, exactly, that example is from Dana Raphael's original essay. So that was published, I think, in 1974. And she, so when I read the word, I ordered this old book and went back to the original essay. And she was an anthropologist. And she writes about how in most every culture and every society across the world, there is this sense of the newborn mother. And cultures have ways of acknowledging that and recognizing it through rites and rituals and ceremony. And, you know, matrescence isn't just, you know, pregnancy and birth. It kind of happens over time as well. And she compares that to North American motherhood at that time of, you know, being in a hospital for a bit and then coming out, and then basically your partner goes to work and then you're on your own. Mm-hmm. And that's matrescence for many people. And yeah, it doesn't need to be like that.
Well, I want to talk, you know, you mentioned metamorphosis. And so I want to talk about how the book is, you know, juxtaposes ideas from scientific research and the natural world with the concept of Metrescence. So between each chapter, you present these beautiful brief vignettes. There's one about other mothers, the behavior of vampire bat mothers, and one about spider mothers who are eaten by their young. One about volcanoes precedes the chapter on childbirth. You even devote an entire chapter to the concept of microchimerism, the idea that mothers retain the cells of the children that they've birthed, and that our children may have our cells and in their bodies. And you present all of these with such nice, artful clarity. And I really thought about your background as like science journalist and having written about nature a lot. But they're also really affecting to read as a mother. The moon one in particular, which I read aloud to my son the other night, brought tears to my eyes. I might just read it because it's very short. Okay, so towards the end of the book is moon. The moon has a new story. It is so similar to the Earth in chemical composition that scientists now believe it may have been formed inside the Earth when Earth was in synestia. A synestia is a state that lasts a couple hundred years. A collision of planet-sized objects spin rapidly in huge pressures at extremely high temperatures, with part of the body in orbit around itself. The moon, researchers think, was produced in the aftermath of a giant impact from chunks of molten rock. The moon, then, was an unpredictable byproduct, and a good one. Can you talk a bit about what it meant to you to weave these stories of the natural world into this book about matrescence and motherhood?
Sure, and thank you for your generous words and reading. Yeah, so I think there was a few things going on. Yeah, at the time, I was feeling like I was in this whirlwind of change, which, if from the outside world, or the mainstream dominant culture, I was expected to just kind of go on as normal and go back to myself, as we've talked about. But actually, I found that I was, you know, having psychological, emotional, spiritual, economic, social change, like everything was swirling around me. And because it took a while for me to find myself in kind of any text that I was reading, like I didn't read Of Woman Born until Adrienne Rich's book, maybe till, I don't know, 6 or maybe 9 months in, or probably around the time of seeing Matrescence. But I found that when I went into the woods, or when I pushed my baby around in this ancient cemetery that I lived next door to, I could see that change and process and metamorphosis was absolutely a hallmark of the natural world, as was symbiosis, as was, you know, interconnectedness and chaos and violence, which is how I, you know, experienced parts of my experience of birth. It was so chaotic. And at the same time, I felt, even though I was a science and nature writer, and I've always been quite suspicious of how ideas of nature and ideas of the natural are employed, you know, to kind of limit thinking and so on. And you know, nature with a capital R, romantic, is quite, you know, basically. But in my matrescence and in the institution of motherhood, I found that the concept of nature was used in such a limiting, oppressive and cruel way. Like, so many women I spoke to and knew felt that they were failing this natural motherhood idea.
Like it's the instinct.
Like, yeah, the natural instinct. Childbirth, or like breastfeeding only, or...
Exactly. And like natural instinct, and, you know, this idea of it being the kind of very intense mother infant dyad without kind of anyone else really, you know, this is a kind of cultural invention and concoction of the last 100 years. Of course, there are a lot of good reasons also for, you know, people to be massively supported in feeding and different types of birth choices, etc. But
it's true, we romanticize it as kind of this animal thing, like I'm just supposed to be feeding my young and, you know, just kind of like nesting with them, and that's because like I'm just a human, I'm an animal, and this is I never thought of it as like that's kind of either a kind of co-opting nature to like have this story that is really just this, you know, maybe totally incorrect or very, very small segment of what occurs naturally.
That's totally it. So yeah, you put it really well. So I felt, you know, it's not the whole picture. Mm-hmm. Like nature is full of chaos and like brutality and like spiders eating their own mothers and volcanoes and planets hitting other planets. And, you know, and it actually makes me quite angry to think that this idea of nature is used to make women feel like they've failed.
Yeah.
You know, like, and also the other thing is that, you know, for 95% of our evolutionary history, you know, we lived in and evolved in collective child-rearing networks where, like some recent studies by a guy called Nikhil Chowdhury, who studies hunter-gatherer groups, found that like mothers would actually only respond to their, be around to respond to their child's needs for 20% of the time. So this like idea of the mother and baby and child being just together all the time and that being like the natural thing, you know.
Yeah, attachment.
Like, you know, is actually, it's totally cultural. And and anyway, so I found a lot of solace and grounding and like refreshing, kind of soothing in thinking about the natural world and, you know, situating myself in those processes. And like, for example, one of my favorite images that really got me through my matrescence was this thing called imaginal discs. So let me explain briefly. When a caterpillar spins a cocoon and a chrysalis, like I thought what happens was like the caterpillar's in the cocoon and then like, you know, some wings just grow out of its body and then it like bites its way out and then goes on its merry way.
Yeah, and but a bunch actually, of kindergartners clap.
Yeah, exactly. But actually what happens is the caterpillar completely dissolves into goo. So it's like a liquid within the cocoon. Mm-hmm. But one thing does remain, and that's these things called imaginal discs. And they're small discs of learning and memory and the things that will go on to be like the butterfly or moth's body. And I found that so, so helpful to be like, hey, I do feel like goo. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I am. I don't know like what is going on. I feel like goo, but maybe it's going to be okay. Like there are these learnings. There's some part of me which is going to you know, move into a different phase.
Something is floating in the goo that is still me and that I will retain when I take a new shape.
Yeah. I read that imaginal discs part like four times because it was so wild. And you mentioned the researchers who confirmed like the memory, like were testing to see if they did retain these memories. And I just, it was like, what? Like, all of these things make me think about just the wonder of it all. And it all feels bigger than the cultural limitations that we maybe initially encounter when we encounter motherhood, you know, when I became pregnant and gave birth for the first time and really realized how little I knew about all of it. And as I grow into motherhood, like I feel more comfortable in like a place of unknowing or a place of wonder and ideally like comfortable in chaos or a sense of loss of control, you know, like that, because that feels more real and true. And somehow that related to the experience of motherhood.
Yeah, I think you put that so well, the wonder and the loss of control. I think that is such like a potentially like generative thing. Like I call this kind of thinking about the maternal and ecology matro ecology. Mm-hmm. And I really think that like matro ecological thinking, like using these stories and myths and not myths, like metaphors from the natural world, to think about how we've constructed care and the family and motherhood, and to think about the maternal, to think about ecology through the maternal, could be so powerful. And the loss of control thing feels so potent to me, because I think that, you know, once you've given birth or you're raising a child, you realize that there's no control, and you know, we're animals and life is chaotic, and actually it's a lot worse than, it's a lot better and a lot worse than we're kind of told it is. And you know, in our current like climate and ecological crisis, I think we could really do with having a bit more like fear about the earth and like kind of awe, like literally awe, like as in the sublime, to like realize that we're not in control, and like this kind of like deception that we have that we are in control and we can dominate and control, which has got us to where we are now. I feel like that could be really eroded with like bringing the maternal experience into the light.
Yeah, there's this beautiful book you're making me think of, The Quickening by Elizabeth Rush. Came out a few years ago. I read it last year and was just really blown away with it. I had a good friend of mine was like, I didn't think you'd be able to like get through the science. And I was like, no, I did it. It was so good. But she talks about, it's like the process of her as a journalist going to Antarctica with a scientific expedition and also thinking about becoming a mother. And I think she speaks to what you're talking about, Lucy, which is like that, she, you know, she's kind of reckoning with the planet as it is and its history and its future and, you know, and the fear that she has and the violence in it. And then, you know, how could you, you know, and then bringing a child into that planet. But I think what she does is what you're kind of calling for is to say that kind of fear of the future isn't, you know, antithetical to motherhood. These things actually, you know, are natural, like, and we can both kind of become mothers and feel desperately afraid about our planet's future and really kind of activated around it and think about this as a natural thing. Like that, again, that kind of re-embracing of natural. I'm wondering, Lucy, if you could talk a little bit about what we do know about matrescence in human mothers, about that process and, you know, the imaginal discs, if you will, that are occurring for us. That no one wants to tell us about.
Yeah, sure. And thank you for mentioning The Quickening. I have always wanted to read that, and I
it's really good
on your recommendation.
Yeah.
So, what do we know? Well, I think we know lots, and we know little. My research threw up a few areas that I found really compelling. One was the newish, groundbreaking neuroscience. So, in 2016, the first really major paper was published, which shows that pregnancy renders pronounced and significant changes in the brain. So researchers could tell the difference between a brain that was pregnant and a brain that wasn't, with lots and lots of different areas which had been altered. And also, we all evolved in collective caregiving networks. So, of course, we all are born with a neural circuitry to look after infants. And therefore, it's no surprise that we now have studies which show that father brain anatomy changes. Obviously, non-biological parent brains change. And that seems to be most often with hands-on care and hands-on affection. So it's the baby who's kind of enacting the change in a parent who hasn't been pregnant and given birth. And of course, we don't need studies to tell us that there's attachment without pregnancy and birth,
but it's nice to have the confirmation. It's nice.
Yeah. I just, you know, it's nice important to say that, you know, it's,
yeah,
you have this like unique endocrinological event in pregnancy, but that doesn't mean that only mothers can obviously are biologically wired to care for children. So, and what that means is many things, but one I will mention is that when a brain is plastic, as it is particularly in adolescence, which we know because we all know adolescents are like feeling pretty weird and kind of like, you know, finding life hard. So we give them more support and understanding. But the matrescent brain is also vulnerable and particularly vulnerable to severe stress. So we know that obviously some stress is fine and normal and good for people, but there are certain types of stress which will make someone's matrescence more dangerous, more perilous. So a lot of this research is done by Pil-Young Kim. I've got more details about it in my book, but briefly, it's things like environmental stress, poverty, racism, domestic abuse, adverse childhood experience, so childhood trauma, birth trauma, you know, temperament of the child, or parenting difficulties. So all those things which are, I'm sure there are more, potentially kind of impacting on a matrescence. I'm sure we'll find out much more about that. We also know that, well, you mentioned it briefly, Miranda, but I think microchimerism is very interesting. And
will you define that one more time for us, Lucy?
Yeah, sure. Anyway. So I guess when I had my child, I was really struck by how I couldn't focus on anything else. And I was, even though, you know, part of me wanted to be back out in the world, but it was almost like I was like a zombie who was just like obsessed with her. You know, if I met my friends. Yeah. If I was like meeting a friend or something, I just couldn't focus on the conversation. You know, it was like she had kind of hijacked me. And I was so intrigued to learn that when a fetus is in a mother or pregnant person's body, cells cross the placenta and they end up in multiple areas of the body, heart, lungs, breasts, brain, sites of disease, sites of repair. Scientists aren't really clear exactly what's happening, but an evolutionary biologist called Amy Boddy I spoke to suggested that there's been enough time and evolution for the baby, the fetus, to work out ways of using that transfer for its benefit. So it might be that those cells are in the mother's body to help lactation. They might be in the brain to help with attachment. And I found that really like upended the patriarchal logic that I'd marinated in throughout my life of individualism. You know, the sense that I was just this kind of self-reliant machine, a mind rather than a body. And I found that quite, you know, soothing in a way, to be like, oh, this is why I feel so different. Maybe it's because, you know, they never actually left my body. So that's quite a long answer, but that's just a few things.
Well, and I was talking to my son about this book last night, and I mean, a little bit, and he was humoring me, and I was talking about, because he knows my C-section scar, and I said, you know, I say that's where you came into the world, and he was born butt first pooping, which I always remind him.
What an entrance.
But you write about evidence that these cells migrate to the incision site and maybe help with healing. And
the cells from the baby.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And
so cool.
So I was like, buddy, like parts of your body like stayed in my body, and then after you were born, they went to that. Because I think it always kind of worries him that I was cut open. I mean, he's very fascinated by it. And then it's like sort of worried about me. And I'm like, no, I'm fine. And so I thought it was cool to say, like, maybe you helped me. You helped me get better.
That's really sweet.
It's just,
and it's really cool that you can show him where the place that where he came from. Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah,
it's, I mean, I talk to my poor children about their births all the time, but I think showing them where they came from might be a bit much.
Yeah, it's a little easier with the C-section scar.
We take a mirror. Me and my kids take a mirror. No, we talk about it. We still take baths together and we talk about it. And, you know, I let them be like, what? Yeah, I mean, it still is a wild idea, you know. My mother is visiting me. She's 80, and you know, she's walking around my apartment this week, and I definitely have thought like, I came out of your vagina, like, you know, I'm just looking right over there. It is, it's hard to wrap your head around.
Griffin talks to my tummy, and he calls it original home. He's like, original home. Sometimes he'll ask to talk to it, and I'll like make my belly button talk.
Yeah, it's like your first apartment, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of, imperfect, that is, but will always be in your heart.
I feel like, I wonder what it will be like when, now that there's like maybe a slightly different culture of talking about birth, and I think it can only be a good thing if we can continue, you know, kids can continue like normalizing where they came from. Because it kind of feels like, you know, in the past, like culture just kind of like shut it down.
Yeah.
There's a great book called Natality. Have you read it?
Mm-hmm.
By Jennifer. Oh, her name's gone. Benson.
Well,
she's a philosopher. And it's a book all about natality and how, you know, thinking about how we were born and how birth happens, and is like super important. But, you know, philosophers have always talked about, you know, philosophy is meant to be about like learning how to die or something like that. Mm-hmm. But like, we need a philosophy about the birth as well.
Well, I kind of want to talk about, we'll add a link to that in our show notes. You know, as we're talking about looking forward, you end the book with the chapter on, I have trouble saying this, matro reform. Thank you. And I really want to hear you sort of talk a little bit about that. You know, what does an optimistic, like, mother future look like to you? Now that you've spent so much time, I mean, this book is so deeply researched. Everyone should read it. It's like, I'm going to give it to every pregnant person I see. I'm just going to have a bag of them and just hand it out.
But I believe you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is my dream.
That means so much to me. I just admire you both so much. So that's thrilling. Matro reform is a word that was coined by Gina Wong Wiley. And yeah, I use it as a chapter heading to think about the future. I think that there are so many ways of building an optimistic mother future. And I guess maybe let's start. I think you can, there's kind of the micro and the macro. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that actually, as much as, you know, there are people like you guys writing a lot about the subject and have, you know, there are books, there are podcasts, there are, you know, there's stuff happening. But actually, my impression from correspondence I've had since Matrescence was published in the UK last summer is that there is a huge amount of just like mainstream suppression of the maternal experience. Mm-hmm. And that while people might have kind of close confidants that they can open up to, there is like an epidemic of like shame and stigma and trauma, actually, like people feeling not just potentially birth trauma, but also traumatized by becoming mothers in a society that is so hostile to mothers. And therefore, and then because our society is so individualistic, mothers blame themselves, they shut down, and they kind of put that in a drawer. And I think we need a revival of consciousness raising groups. And obviously, like, this is like a consciousness raising group, your podcast, but ooh, like,
I
think that,
thank you,
but you know, that was a thing in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know, there's, I feel like that, it just feels like crazy to think that in 2024 we're in a place where 50 years after like the women's lib movement began, we're still struggling with like so many of the things, like childcare, like proper maternal mental health care, maternal health, like structural racism, like ethnic and social class, you know, socioeconomic disparities. Like,
well, and as you point out, like, there's still so little research on motherhood. And that's ridiculous. The years of the studies that you list in your book are appalling. It's like, you know, last month they came out with the first study of, you know, maternal depression.
Because you wrote about like Zuranolone, the drug, and I covered that last summer. And I was thinking, you added, that must have been added, like, because it was like very recently approved.
Yeah, you're exactly. Like, are these typos that there wasn't actually, you know, there wasn't a single study of like, right, the prenatal brain, you know, the pregnant brain until you're like,
I mean,
20?
That was prevalent.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah, so
and we only just found out, yeah, and we only just found out like what the hormone, the thing is that creates, scare quotes, morning sickness.
Oh, yes.
Like they only
all
just figured
sickness.
Out like what that is. Like how has it been that long? So I think that like, even though, I don't know, maybe it's because I grew up in quite a kind of conservative, like very Christian upbringing. So like, I don't know, I feel like my first thought is always like, everything's fine, or, you know, it's not that bad. You know, like, we've had, feminism has like won some stuff, and but actually I think we're a lot more oppressed as mothers than like the dominant culture would acknowledge. So I think like talking, sharing, and a cultural environment that brings women together to organize and to fight for each other's rights and to kind of fess up to how the institution of motherhood is failing and inadequate. And then, I mean, like, there are little things that, you know, you see, like, now in England, there are stickers on, like, trains and buses with, like, a woman with a young child on her lap. So that's happened in the last, like, 5 years. Because, like, when I first became a mum, you'd get on a train with, like, a young child, or you'd be, like, heavily pregnant. No one would look at you. Mm-hmm. You had no rights to sit down or to, like, take up any space. It was, like, travelling on the trains in England. It was just, like, a nightmare. Like,
we couldn't have a buggy. But not, I've never seen the little babies. I've never seen someone, a mother, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's quite new, that one here. And I think it's like pretty powerful, but that doesn't happen until women are like, hello, like we need, you know, all these decisions that were made for us are not okay. Like we need to actually make these decisions about infrastructure and, you know, how our lives are designed. And an optimistic mother culture.
I know, it's sort of, well, I can read, I don't know how much more I should read, but you write in that chapter, you say, like, let's get down to the bones, which I really, really resonated. And you kind of get into just all of the ways that our society is really not structured for children and families. And like, I think I've been living and breathing this topic for years now, really as you did, where it's a personal like effort to understand what happened to me. And then as a writer to say to other people, hey, something's crazy here. And I got to tell you about it because maybe it will be better for you. And I was actually interviewing Emily Oster recently and about her new book. Her first book was the same. It was like, oh, surely someone has written this book. I'll just go looking for the book that will answer all my questions.
Yeah, expecting and then, better, right? She starts with like, she gets pregnant and she drinks, she like, wants to know if she can have coffee. And she's like, well, there must be like someone who's looked at the research. No
one's done it yet. So you're like, I guess I'll do it. You know, it's like when I, one of the first pieces I wrote for Romper, I was like, it was after the birth of my second child. And I was like, gosh, I was put on sertraline just as you write about, and which is Zoloft, and right for a lot of people, wrong for me. And that was when I looked around and almost every mother in my life said, oh yeah, me too, I'm on that, or I'm on Lexapro or whatever. Again, great for the people who need it. Also being used not the way they're meant to be used, not meant to be taken indefinitely, not meant to be not the appropriate treatment for what I had, which was I think self-diagnosing after the fact, like a classic 3-day hormone crash related to delivering the placenta, which you write about in the book as a new endocrine organ. And I knew that, but I didn't know that until you articulated it in that way. Like an organ whose purpose is like to pump me full of hormones.
Right. And then it comes out.
Me. And then it comes, it just goes. And so it was my OB prescribed me Zoloft. And then about a week or two later, I was speaking with a doula and I said what happened to me, which was that I felt like I had psychosis or something. I mean, I couldn't sleep. I just felt totally out of my body and weird. And she just normalized, you know, she just said, oh, you know, I think that was a 3-day hormone crash. And here's what I think happened. And it was like your feeling of the shoulders drop, like, oh, that's normal. Like, oh.
So that's part of that optimistic maternal future, I think, that you're talking about, Lucy, is like to have OBs know that that's a possibility, you know?
And to talk, you know, I think Sarah and I have talked about how do we help other mothers? How do we help? You know, you've read so much about this and you talk about biopsychosocial. We need that approach, like looking at the biological changes, psychological changes, neurological changes, hormonal changes. And I feel like this book is an effort to put that out into the world and sort of write the unified theory of matrescence, like, not theory, but sort of concept. And feels like, in a way, like, why is this book new? Like,
well, it's here now.
It's here now. Thank goodness. The future is now. but I would love to hear, you know, what do you do for new mothers in your life with everything that you know now? What is your sort of impulse?
Sure. And yeah, first just to say, I'm sorry that happened to you. And like, how absurd that that OB doesn't know about what the placenta is. And like, I was so shocked when I found out that some hormones like increase by like hundreds and like even thousand. I was like, this is major. This is like seismic. This, why is it so minimized? Anyway, thank you for your kind words. What am I doing for new mothers? I mean, I think I really like to, maybe I'm a bit intense about it, but whenever a friend has a baby, you know, I'm very much like, how are you? How is your matrescence? And like,
you know, woman has given birth.
Let's give birth. Like, I make greetings cards which say like, matrescence love to you. So I always try and send a card to the mum as well, as you know. You know, I'm really lucky that I've got this book, which is a kind of vehicle for creating events and having conversations and, you know, taking up some space and trying to kind of gather people together. I would like more men to come to my events. I mean, it is predominantly women, but I think, you know, men are like, everyone is part of this like ongoing like need to transform things. I'm starting to be a bit less sleep deprived, although last night was a shocker. But I would honestly say that like I am still slightly in survival mode. So, but I feel like I'm coming out of it maybe a bit, and that I would like to focus some of my effort on like doing some of the like political like fighting that like new mothers just can't do because they're absolutely knackered and like in shock. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to forget about my matrescence, which maybe I think it's all ever changing. Actually, I don't know if it's just one thing, but I feel really strongly for new mothers, particularly those who I often meet at my events who seem to be really traumatized and like that, you know, kind of sense of being abandoned by society and kind of abandoned in, you know, in birth and in, you know, by the culture. And I think that is something which can be not healed, but can be soothed by other people who have, not saying that's me, but I'm just saying like in a group, you know, or in a circle, or like listening to a podcast like this. Mm-hmm. Like my village has often been listening to podcasts, you know, and hearing other women articulate this and feeling like, you know, you're not alone and it's not your fault. It's like a society which is like incredibly hostile to caregivers.
Yes.
I don't know. What about you guys? Yes. What, I mean, you're doing this is what you're doing this, though. You're doing this. But like,
I always feel weird. I think
Miranda walks around with a bag of books. We've established that.
I'm going to. You know, I want to. I should. I have all my favorite little motherhood
books. You have totes. You have plenty of totes, too.
I have t-shirts. I've got t-shirts. I'll send you guys one.
Yes, right.
I saw those. Aren't
they individual?
The social media.
Yeah. I'm just getting another batch printed, but they say matrescence on them. And I think that's kind of a cool thing to like get people talking.
Yes,
that could be the summer reading club t-shirt reward.
Well, I was thinking we could give the summer reading club reward. I mean, I guess they don't want books, but we could give them matrescence.
No, we're grown-ups. Yeah. We do want more books. If you're reading and you're, you know, in your 40, you do want more books.
You want more books.
It's such a good question, Lucy. I wanted to, and I so appreciate your sentiment about like not leaving new mothers behind. I think, you know, parenthood is so myopic and, you know, you're kind of thinking about like the, you know, 6 to 24 month stage that your children are in and all of usually your friends' children are in and whatever, like, the kind of developmental challenges of that stage are, right? Like, oh, it's everybody's getting phones. What do we do there? And you do leave other kind of stages behind because you have to, and you like do not think about the future, you know, like you arrive in like the land of having teenagers, like, oh fuck. And so I think that that is a survival instinct, but I really think your sentiment is beautiful about like, let's not just say like, yeah, I got through it, you know, like I'm, yeah, let's like think about, because we have more energy, what we can actually do to make the matrescence easier for those in our community. So I like the idea of upping my game around new mothers. I'm not having a lot in my life because of my age now. So I did kind of imagine I would be this like wise auntie that, you know, that brought like, you know, everyone was bringing clothes for the baby and I had like the basket of herbs and shit. But it just, the opportunity hasn't come up that much. But maybe that's a call to kind of look for it in the community and be more formally a bit of a mentor and walk around with a tote bag full of books.
I think we got to make our tote bags. I think I honestly think having these words, like wearing them on my body to almost advertise, like, you know, ask me about what's about to happen. Like, are you pregnant? Ask me about it. Like, I have felt that just being honest about what happened to you, you know, I don't know what will happen to whoever I encounter who's about to be a mother, but I can share honestly my story. And I think that alone is very powerful and also hard to do. Like not we've talked a lot about trauma, birth trauma, this is the trauma of becoming a mother in our culture, which doesn't recognize or support or value them. And so I think maybe healing that trauma, facing it head on, like giving it a voice, you know, being kind to yourself about what happened to you. Like, first you have to start with your own matrescence, I think. And then you can extend that compassion to others.
Put your matrescence mask on first.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly. and so I feel fortunate because this is like my job. Like I couldn't stop thinking about it so much that I made it my job to think about it. But
we're really just giving ourselves therapy here, one hour at a time.
I mean,
matrescence.
I love the group idea too. You know, there's some places here that I don't think existed when I was going through my first matrescence. There's a place called Partum Gardens, and it's like this garden, and it's a weekly thing, and it's at a set time, and you just show up, and I think there's tea and they talk, and it seems very casual, but it honestly seems like almost all you need to, like,
that sounds awesome.
No,
yeah, because I feel like also the like essentially like our economic system and our political system is rotten, right? Like it's inadequate and it conceals the work of care, and it's like a myth, because like GDP is like a myth because it doesn't include production and reproduction of the workers. And it's kind of like we're living in this world where domestic and like care work is still so hidden, and our dominant economy based on profit and growth, like, it takes advantage of mostly women and kind of free rides off our care work, as it does to, you know, as it exploits many other people in other countries and habitats and so on. Mm-hmm. But so I kind of also think that it helps new mothers for us to try and like set fire to that. Mm. And actually, like, there's like the fundamental, I think the foundations of our like global North ideas and ideologies is not fit for purpose. And it does, because it's like our ways of thinking just don't, it's inadequate now. And so we need like the maternal and, you know, that the voice of carers to dismantle what is doesn't serve us. And we can only do that through talking together and, you know, joining our voices.
Beautiful.
Thank you for joining your voice with us, Lucy.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us. This was so fascinating. And
I love talking to you guys. I hope we can meet one day. I just love the pod and your writing, and it's really cool to be here.
Well, thank you. We were so excited. And thank you for this beautiful book.
Is there any other culture other than your book, which everybody should get? I believe if you're listening to this, it'll come out tomorrow in the States. We'll put a link in our show notes. Anything else in the culture that you've been loving for yourself or as a family?
Well, I will. I don't know if you guys know Andrea O'Reilly. Oh. So she is like the most incredible thinker and academic. She created motherhood studies like 20 years ago. She set up Demeter Press, which is like a feminist press, and a big collection of her writings on motherhood is being published this year. And she has been studying the subject for like 20, 30 years and advocating for mothers and motherhood studies. She is like a genius and like undersung. So I feel like, I think it's called Mother Words, her new book. I want to recommend that. It's really brilliant. And I am reading, what are we watching as a family? Oh, it's such a cliche, but Bluey. We just watched that. Oh, Bluey.
The Sign. About. Did you watch The Sign? The new.
Yeah.
Is that the 30-minute Bluey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I just know. I just bought a Bluey sweatshirt from Target, and people keep commenting on it. I can't tell if they're like, they just think it's too awkward not to say something, or like some of them legitimately are like, "Fuck yeah, Bluey sweatshirt." But I just saw. I haven't read it yet, but I saw that W. Kamau Bell, an American comedian and journalist who's fabulous, wrote a Substack newsletter post that where the title was "Bluey is the Breaking Bad of family television." So now I've been saying that whenever people compliment the shirt, is I'm like, well, you know, it's the Breaking Bad of family television, and I feel like that legitimizes it. I mean, it is TV for the whole family. So no shame or cliche in Bluey.
We were watching Bluey this morning and I was like thinking about this, and I was like thinking about what feels different about it and why it feels different. And there's like a lot of things to say, but that lots of people have already said, but you know, it respects the family.
Yeah.
Like the show respects the family, and that is what feels different to me, I think. Like very, very, very few places that families get respect.
You mean like as viewers or within the content of the...
All of it. Like respected as something rich and complex and beautiful.
Right.
And
we're not just complaining about the parents.
Interesting. And
The parents are like individuals in their own right, aren't they, a bit? Like in England, the kind of biggest one before Bluey was Peppa Pig.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have avoided that. It's like the dad, Daddy Pig. It's like, it's just such a cliche of like bad, you know, like just being, you know, like a rubbish dad. It's just so boring.
And they're so mean to him all the time. They're always like, oh, Daddy Pig, you dummy, like you bad idiot. And you're just like, you got
I
it.
Wonder if there's like a correlation between that and the fact in England, like basically no one took up shared parental leave. Like they tried to give like dads the option, and like
I don't want to be
failed basically.
Daddy Pig.
Right. Yeah. And everyone Daddy wants to be here. Bandit. Like Bandit's a hero. Yeah. You know?
Cool.
He's
dad.
A true hero.
Yeah,
cool
I am dad. Not very good at playing, but I get some good tips from that guy. Some good games.
Yeah. I like to think I'm like a little bit Bandit. A little bit. What's the mom's name?
Chili.
Chili, you know? I'm like, all the episodes where Chili's like organized and Bandit's not, I'm like, I'm the Bandit. Like my husband is Chili. He like brings the bag to the pool. And I'm like, what really is sunblock? It's just, you know, it's just lotion with good branding. But then, right, all the like playing stuff, I'm like, peace, I'll be reading on the couch.
So, okay, Lucy, we'll wrap up, but what's your favorite Bluey episode?
Oh, good question.
Oh, I don't think I can answer that because I don't know it like as well as, you know, I don't know it. Okay. So, but there's the one, I guess the one that I love is the one that my kids always do impressions of and find hilarious, which is like the unicorns.
Oh, unicorns.
Yeah. Unicorns.
I don't think I've seen that one.
Where he's like, wah, 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 wah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, you
what about you, Miranda?
Baby Race.
Baby Race.
Baby Race.
I don't think I've seen that.
Go okay, watch I'm going to look that up.
My, I think it's my since favorite.
Season one.
Okay.
Oh, and Ben Knight. I'm sorry.
Ben Knight. Ben Knight's really good. Okay. Ben Knight's really beautiful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wrote a whole article. I wrote like 2,000 words about my favorite Bluey episode Romper.
What is your favorite?
It's Army. It's one of the ones where like the kids aren't like you don't really see the Bluey family. It's like a new kid coming to the like magical woodland Waldorf school that they go to, who like in my mind, because I project, clearly has ADHD and maybe learning disabilities.
Yes. Yeah.
And then he plays Army with this other kid. And then I also granddad an absolute beautiful tearjerker. Whenever like either of those episodes come on, my kids like call me from the other room. Yeah. And then they'll be like, mama's crying.
Yeah, yeah, that's what Baby Race will make you cry. You will.
Okay,
cry.
I'm gonna go watch
but
that
it's
now.
Such a good feeling. Yeah, go watch it. 7 minutes. Because
you can watch it without
got
your
7 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, and I do. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was a delight, and I hope we'll have you back sometime.
I'd love to be a friend of the pod in that way. Thank you. Definitely. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you for listening to The Mother of It All. And like my mom always said, I'm a cockroach now. The Mother of It All is produced by Opus Knox Media with music from It's Electric. You can follow us on Substack at motherofitall.substack.com, where subscribing will get you episodes and bonus posts in your inbox, chat and comment features, episode transcripts, and more. And on Instagram at The Mother of It All. We know you are profoundly busy, but if you like listening and can manage to follow, rate, or review us in a small moment between leaning in and having it all, it will help us reach a wider audience and meet our stretch goal of getting Michelle Obama on the pod. Thanks for your support. Now get out there and have a totally passable day.